was a guy Gately and Fackelman know only as 80s Bill, an impeccably groomed guy that wore red suspenders under snazzy Zegna brand menswear and tortoiseshell specs and docksiders, an old-fashioned corporate takeoverer, an asset plunderer, maybe 50, with an Exchange Place office and a souvenir Free Milken bumper sticker on his Beamer. It was a night of many highballs and much papoosing, and Gately had to keep flicking the top of PHJ's skull to keep her conscious long enough to free associate her way through the details. Who was on his fourth marriage to his third aerobics instructor, and who liked to bet only on Ivy League college hoops. But who, when he did so, bet amounts so huge that Fackelman always had to get Sorkin's pre-approval on the bet, and then call 80s Bill back, and so on. But so, according to Pamela Hoffman Jeep, this 80s Bill, who's a Yale alum and usually unabashedly sentimental about what Pamela H.J. laughingly says Fackelman called his alma mater. Well, on this particular time, it seems like a little impeccably groomed birdie has whispered in 80s Bill's hairy ear, because this one time 80s Bill wants to put $125K down on Brown U against Yale U, that is, betting against his alma mater. Only he wants minus 2 points instead of the even spread. Sorkin and the rest of the Boston books are taking off the Atlantic City line for a spread. And Fackelman has to cell phone down to Saugus to bounce this off Sorkin, except Sorkin's down in the city in Enfield at the National Craniofacial Pain Foundation office, getting his weekly UV bombardment and Kaffergott refill from Dr. Robert 60s Bob Monroe, the septuagenarian pink sunglasses and Nehru jacket-wearing NCFPF, ergotic vascular headache treatment specialized, a guy who, in your days, interned at Sandoz and was one of T. Leary's original circle of mayonnaise jar acid droppers at T. Leary's now legendary house in West Newton, Massachusetts, and is now, 60s Bob, an intimate acquaintance of Kite. Because 60s Bob is an even bigger Grateful Dead fanatic, maybe even than Kite, and sometimes got together with Kite and several other dead devotees, most of who now had canes and O2 tanks, and traded historical souvenir-type tiger's eyes and paisley doublets and tie-dyes and lava lamps and bandanas and plasma spheres and variegated black light posters of involuted geometric designs, and argued about which dead shows and bootlegs of dead shows were the greatest of all time in different regards, and just basically had a hell of a time. 60s Bob, an inveterate collector and haggling trader of shit, sometimes took Kite along on little expeditions of eclectic and seedy shops for dead-related paraphernalia, sometimes even informally fencing stuff for Kite, and so, indirectly, Gately, covering Kite with money when Kite's rigid need schedule didn't permit a more formal and time-consuming fence. 60s Bob then trading the merchandise around various seedy locales for 60s-related shit nobody else would even usually want. A couple times Gately had to actually finger an ice cube out of a highball and slip it under the shoulderless neckline of PHJ's prom gown to try to keep her on some kind of track. Like most incredibly passive people, the girl had a terrible time ever separating details from what was really important to a story. It's why she rarely ever got asked anything. But, so, the point is that the person that took Fackelman's call about 80s Bill's mammoth Yale Brown bet wasn't, in fact, Sorkin, but rather Sorkin's secretary, one Gwendine O'Shea, the howitzer-breasted, old, green-cardless former IRA moll who'd gotten hit on the head with a truncheon by a godless Belfast bobby once too often back on the old sod, and whose skull now was, in Fackelman's own terminology, soft as puppy shit in the rain, but who had just the seedy sort of distracted, grandmotherly air that makes her perfect for clapping her red-knuckled old hands to her cheeks and squealing as she claimed mass lottery winnings whenever Whitey Sorkin and his M.A. Statehouse bagman cronies arranged to have a Sorkinite buy a mysteriously winning mass lottery ticket from one of the countless convenience stores Sorkin and cronies own through dummy corporations all up and down the North Shore, and who, because she could not only give what Sorkin claimed was the only adequate cervical massage west of the Bern Hot Alp Springs Center, but also could both word process a shocking 110 words per minute and wield a shillelagh like nobody's business, plus had been W. Sorkin's dear late IRA Mall Mum's Scrabble pal back in Belfast on the old sod, served as Whitey's chief administrative aide, manning the cellular phones when Sorkin was out or indisposed. And so, but PHJ's point, which Gately has to just about crack her scalp open, flicking out of her, Gwendine O'Shea, familiar with 80s Bill and his YU Bulldog sentimentality, plus cranially soft as a fucking grape, O'Shea took Fackelman's call wrong. Thought Fackelman said 80s Bill wanted $125K with minus 2 points on Yale instead of minus two on Brown. Put Fackelman on hold and made him listen to Irish Muzak while she put in a call to a Yale athletic department mole out of Sorkin's Reed-protected databases mole file, and learned that the Yale U Bulldog star power forward had been diagnosed with an extremely rare neurologic disorder called postcoital vestibulitis,
375,
in which, for several hours after intercourse, the power forward tended to suffer such a terrible, vertiginous loss of proprioception that he literally couldn't tell his ass from his elbow, much less make an authoritative move to the bucket. Plus then O'Shea's second call to Sorkin's Brown U athletic mole, a locker room attendant everybody thinks is deaf, reveals that several of Brown U's most sirenish and school-spirited hetero co-eds had been recruited, auditioned, briefed, rehearsed, that is, debriefed, giggles Pamela Hoffman-Jeep, whose giggles involve the sort of ticklish, shoulder-writhing undulations of a much younger girl getting tickled by an authority figure and pretending not to like it, and stationed at strategic points, I-95 rest stops, in the spare tire compartment at the rear of the Bulldog's chartered bus, in the evergreen shrubbery outside the team's special entrance to the Pizzatola Athletic Center in Providence, in concave recesses along the Pizzatola tunnels between special entrance and visitor's locker room, even in a specially enlarged and sensually appointed locker next to the power forward's locker in the VLR, all prepared, like the Brown cheerleaders and pep squad who've been induced to do the game pantyless, electrolyzed, and splits-prone, to help lend a pyrotechnic, glandular atmosphere to the power forward's whole playing environment, prepared to make the penultimate sacrifice for squad, school, and influential members of the Brown Alumni Bruins Boosters Association, so that Gwendine O'Shea then switches back to Fackelman and okays the mammoth bet and point spread, as like, who wouldn't, with that kind of mole-reported fix in the works? Except, of course, she's taken the wager backwards. That is, O'Shea thinks 80s Bill's now got $125K on Yale coming within 2 points, while 80s Bill, who it turns out's cast himself as White Knight in bidding for majority control of Providence's Federated Funnel and Cone Corporation, ONAN's leading manufacturer of conoid receptacles with FF&C, CEO'd by a prominent Brown alumnus so rabid a Bruins booster, he actually wears a snarling, hollow bear head to conference games, whose ass 80s Bill is going about kissing like nobody's beeswax, PHJ inserts, hinting it was 80s Bill who tipped the Bruins staff off about the power forward's Achilles' vas deferens. EB quite reasonably believes he's now got Brown within a deuce for 125 El Grandes. The wrench in the ointment that nobody in Providence has counted on is the picket and knuckle duster wielding appearance of Brown University's entire Dworkinite female objectification prevention and protest phalanx outside the Pizzatola Athletic Center's main gates right at game time. Two FOPPPs per motorcycle who blow through the filigreed gates like they were so much wet Kleenex and storm the arena, plus a division of Brown's pluckier undergraduate NOWs who execute a pincer movement down from the cheap seats up top during the first timeout, at the precise moment The Brown cheerleaders' first pyramid maneuver ends in a midair split that causes the Pizzatola's scoreboard scorekeeper to reel backward against his controls and blow out both Holmes and visitors' zeros on the scoreboard, just as the FOPPP's unmuffled hogs come blatting, malevolently, down through the ground-level tunnels and out onto the playing floor. And in the ensuing melee, not only are cheerleaders, pep squad, and comely Brown U sirens all either laid out with picket signs, wielded like shillelaghs, or thrown kicking and shrieking over the burly shoulders of militant FOPPPs and carried off on roaring hogs, leaving the Yale power forward's delicate nervous system intact, if overheated. But two Brown U Bruin starters, a center and a shooting guard, both too wrung out and dazed by a grueling week of comely siren auditioning and rehearsing to have sense enough to run like hell once the melee spills out onto the Pizzatola hardwood, are felled by an FOPPP knuckle duster and a disoriented referee with a martial arts background, respectively. And so, when the floor is finally cleared, and stretchers borne off and the game resumes, Yale U cleans Brown U's clock by upwards of 20. Then so Fackelman calls up 80s Bill and arranges to pick up the skeet, which is $137,500 with the VIG, which EB gives him in large denomination pre-ONAN scrip, in a Go Brown Bruins gym bag he'd brought to the game to sit next to the Ursine-headed CEO with, and now has less than no use for. But so Fackelman receives the skeet downtown and blasts up cheesy Route 1 to Saugus to deliver the skeet and pick up his VIG on the VIG, $625 U.S., right away, needing to cop blues in what's starting to be the worst way, etc. Plus, Fackelman's figuring on maybe a small bonus, or at least some emotional validation from Sorkin, for bringing in such a mammoth and promptly remitted wager. But when he gets to the Route 1 titty bar, at the rear of which Sorkin has his administrative offices behind an unmarked fire door, and all wallpapered and stuff that looks like ersatz wood paneling, Gwendine O'Shea wordlessly points behind her station at Sorkin's personal office door with a terse gesture Fackelman doesn't think fits with the upbeatness of the occasion at all. The door's got a big poster of Rush Limbaugh on it, from before the assassination. Sorkin's in there working spreadsheets with his special monitor screen light filtering goggles on. The goggles' lenses, on their long protruding barrels, look like lobsters' eyes on stalks. Gately and Fackelman and Bobby C. never spoke to Sorkin until spoken to, not out of henchmanish obsequity, but because they could never tell what Sorkin's craniofacial vascular condition was, or if he could tolerate sound until they verifiably heard him tolerating his own sound. So G. Fackelman waits, wordlessly, to hand over 80s Bill's skeet, standing there tall and soft and palely sweating, the overall shape and color of a peeled boiled egg. When Sorkin hikes an eyebrow at the Go Bruins bag and says the knee-slapping hilarity of the joke escapes him, Fackelman's mustache positively takes off all over his upper lip, and he prepares to say what he always says when he's flummoxed, that whatever is being said is, with all due respect, goddamn lie. Sorkin saves his data and pushes his desk chair back so he can reach all the way down to the fireproof drawer. The goggles are often used in data processing sweatshops and list for a deuce. Sorkin grunts as he hauls out a huge old mass lottery box for quick-pick cards and heaves it onto the desk, where it bulges obscenely, filled with 112.5K U.S. There's 112.5 fucking K in there, all in ones. 125K minus VIG, what Sorkin, via O'Shea, believes to be 80s Bill's winnings, all in small bills, because Sorkin's pissed off and can't resist making a little, like, gesture. Fackelman doesn't say anything. His mustache goes limp as his mental machinery starts revving. Sorkin, massaging his temples, staring up at Fackelman with his goggles like a crab in a tank, says he supposes he can't blame Fax or O'Shea, that he'd have okayed the bet himself, what with the neurologic tip on the Yale forward they had. Who could have foreseen thuggish feminazis screwing up the ointment? He utters a bit of Gaelic that Fackelman doesn't know but assumes to be fatalistical. He peels 6 C notes and an ON Aeonite 25 spot off a wad the size of an artillery shell and pushes them across the metal desk at Fackelman. He is Vig on the Vig. He says, "What the fuck?" Sorkin does. This 80s Bill kid's irrational sentimentalism for Yale will, sooner or later, catch up with him. Veteran books tend to be statistically philosophical and patient. Fackelman doesn't even bother to wonder why Sorkin refers to 80s Bill as kid when they're both about the same age. But a high-watt bulb is slowly beginning to incandesce over Fackelman's moist head. As in, the Faxter starts to conceptualize the overall concept of what must have happened. "He still hasn't said anything," Pamela Hoffman Jeep emphasizes. Sorkin looks Fackelman over and asks if he's gained some asymmetrical type weight there. Fackelman's left tit does look noticeably bigger than his right under his sport coat because of the legal envelope with 137 thousands and 1 500 in it, the skeet from an 80s Bill who thought he'd lost, just like Sorkin thought EB'd won. The slight high whine in the room that Sorkin thinks is his Infernitron disk drive is really the whine of Fackelman's high-speed mentation. His mustache rolls like a cracked whip as he works his own internal mental spreadsheet. 250K in one lumpy sum represented like 375 sky blue grams of hydromorphone hydrochloride.
376.
Or like 37,500 10 milligram soluble tablets of the shit, available from a certain rapacious but discreet Chinatown opiate dealer who'd only deal synthetic narcs in 100 gram weights, which all translated, assuming Kite could be persuaded to pack up his DEC 2100 and move far, far away with Fackelman to help him set up a street distribution matrix in some urban market far, far away into close to, like, let's see, carry the one, like 1.9 million in street value, which some meant that Fackelman, and to a lesser junior partner extent Kite, could have their chins on their chests for the rest of their days without ever having to strip another apartment, forge another passport, break another thumb. All if Fackelman just kept his map shut about O'Shea's confabulation of Yale, Brown, Brown, Yale, mumbled something about an IV adulterant causing a sudden and temporary gigantism in one tit, and blasted out of there straight down Route 1 to this one Dr. Wu and Associates, Hung Toy's Cold Tea Emporium, Chinatown. By this time, Pamela Hoffman Jeep had succumbed to the highballs and her own swaddled warmth and was irreversibly swooned, ice or Philip or no, twitching synaptically and murmuring to somebody named Monty that he was certainly no kind of gentleman in her book. But Gately could chart the rest of Fackelman's Shit Creek's course for himself. When approached by Fackelman with a Go Brown gym bag of Dr. Wu's finest wholesale Dilaudid, and invited to decamp with him and set up a distrib matrix for their own drug empire far, far away, Kite would have staggered back in horror at Fackelman's obviously not knowing that the better, 80s Bill, was in fact none other than the son of 60s Bob, namely, Whitey Sorkin's personal migraineologist, who Sorkin trusted and confided in, as only a massive IV dose of Cafergot can make you trust and confide, and whom Sorkin would undoubtedly tell all about the guy's own son's huge win on Yale, and who wasn't like Ward and Wally close with his son, 60s Bob wasn't, but naturally kept distant paternal tabs on him, and would certainly have known that EB'd in fact bet Brown in an attempt to cozy up to the conic CEO, and so would know that there'd been some kind of mix-up. And also that Kite'd still be staggering back in horror as all this added up. Plus, even if Sorkin somehow didn't get told of 80s Bill's loss and Fackelman's scam from 60s Bill, the fact was that Sorkin's newest, savagest, U.S. Muscle, Bobby C. C., old-fashioned smack addict, copped regular old organic Burmese heroin from this Dr. Wu on a regular basis, and was sure to hear about 300-plus grams of wholesale Dilaudid bought by a Fackelman known to be C.'s co-employee off Sorkin. And thus, that Fackelman, who, when he came to cut with the proposition, was already in possession of a brown booster bag full of 37,500 10-milligram Dilaudids and minus Sorkin's 250K, plus with, as Gately later knew, only 22K in suicidal scam-back fire insurance capital, was already dead. Fackelman was a dead man, Kite would have said, staggering back with horror at Fax's idiocy. Kite'd have said he could smell Fackelman already biodegrading from here. Dead as a fucking post, he'd have told Fackelman, already worrying about being seen sitting there with him in whatever titty bar they were in when Fax hit Kite with the proposal. And Gately, watching PHJ sleep, could not only imagine but identify, fully, with how Fackelman, on hearing Kite say he could smell him dead and why, with how Fackelman, instead of taking his bag full of blues and gluing on a goatee and immediately fleeing to climes that had never even fucking heard of Metro Boston's North Shore, that the Faxter done what any drug addict in possession of his substance would do when faced with fatal news and attendant terror. Fackelman made a fucking beeline for their luxury-stripped home and familiar safe-feeling hearth, and it plopped down and immediately fired up the sterno cooker and cooked up and tied off and shot up and nailed his chin to his chest and kept it there with staggering quantities of Dilaudid, trying to mentally blot out the reality of the fact that he was going to get demapped if he didn't take some kind of decisive remedial action at once. Because, Gately realized even then, this was your drug addict's basic way of dealing with problems, was using the good old substance to blot out the problem. Also, probably, medicating his terror by stuffing himself with peanut M&Ms, which would explain all the wrappers littering the floor of the corner he hadn't moved from. That thus, this is why Fackelman had been squatting, moist and silent, in a corner of the living room, right outside this very bedroom here for days. This was why the apparent contradiction of the staggering amount of substance Fackelman had in the gym bag next to him, together with the cornered toad look of a man in the great fear one associates with withdrawal. Charting and thinking, drumming his fingers absently on PHJ's unconscious skull, Gately realized he could more than empathize with Fackelman's flight into Dilaudid and M&Ms. But now he realizes that that was the first time it really ever dawned on him, in force, that a drug addict was, at root, a craven and pathetic creature, a thing that basically hides. The most sexual thing Gately ever did with Pamela Hoffman Jeep was he liked to unwrap her cocoon of blankets and climb in with her and spoon in real tight, fitting his bulk up close against all her soft, concave places, and then go to sleep with his face in her nape. It bothered Gately that he could empathize with Fackelman's desire to hide and blot out. But in the retrospective memory, now it bothers him more that he didn't lie there, up next to the comatose girl, being bothered for more than a few minutes before he felt the familiar desire that blots out all bother, and that night, he had unwrapped the cocoon of bedding and arisen so automatically in service of this desire. And feels the worst of all that he'd lumbered out of the bedroom, in just jeans and belt, out to the gloaming living room where Fackelman was hunched, moist, and smeary-mouthed, in the corner next to a mountain of 10-milligram Dilaudids, and his mixing bowl of distilled water, and works kit and sterno unit. That Gately had lumbered so automatically out to Fackelman under the pretense, to himself, too, the pretense was the worst thing, the pretense that he was just going to check on poor old Fackelman, to maybe try and convince him to take some kind of action, go penitent to Sorkin, or flee the climb, instead of just hiding there in the corner with his mind in neutral and his chin on his chest, and a stalactite of chocolated drool from his lower lip lengthening. because he knew that the first thing Fackelman would do when Gately left PHJ and lumbered out to the defurnished living room would be to fumble in his Gore-Tex works kit for a new factory-wrapped syringe and invite Gately to hunker on down and get right with the planet. That is, ingest some of this mountain of Delauded to keep Fackelman company. Which, to Gately's shame, he did, had done, and no part of the reality of Fackelman's Creek and the need for action had even been brought up, so intent were they on the blues' somnolent hum, blotting everything out, while Pamela Hoffman Jeep lay wrapped tight in the other room, dreaming of damsels and towers. Gately did, he remembers vividly, he let Fackelman fix them both up but good, and told himself he was doing it to keep Fackelman company, like sitting up with a sick friend, and, maybe worst, believed it was true. Little entr'acts of feverish dreams punctuate memories and being conscious, like he dreams he's riding due north on a bus, the same color as its own exhaust, passing again and again the same gutted cottages, an expanse of heaving sea, weeping. The dream goes on and on, without any kind of resolution or arrival, and he weeps and sweats as he lies there, stuck in it. Gately comes sharply around when he feels the little rough tongue on his forehead, not unlike Nimitz, the MP's little pet kitten's hesitant tongue. When the MP still had the kitten, before the mysterious period where the kitten disappeared and the garbage disposal wouldn't run right for days, and the MP sat hungover with his notebook at the kitchen table with his blonde head in his hands, just sat there for several days, and Gately's mom went around pale as hell and wouldn't go near the kitchen sink for days, and rushed to the bathroom when Gately finally asked, what was the deal with the garbage disposal? And where was Nimitz? When Gately gets his eyelids unstuck, though, the tongue is not even close to being Nimitz's. The Wraith is back, right by the bed, dressed like before, and blurred at the edges in the hat-shadowed spill of hallway light, and except now with him is another, younger, way more physically fit Wraith, in kind of faggy biking shorts and a U.S. tank top, who's leaning way over Gately's railing and fucking licking Gately's forehead with a rough little tongue. And as Gately reflexively strikes out at the guy's map, no man put his tongue on D.W. Gately and lived, he has just enough time to realize the Wraith's breath has no warmth to it, or smell, before both Wraiths vanish, and a blue-forked bolt of pain from his sudden striking out sends him back against his hot pillow with an arched spine and a tube, impeded scream, his eyes rolling back into the dove-colored light of whatever isn't quite sleep. His fever is way worse, and his little snatches of dreams have a dismantled cubist aspect he associates in memory with childhood flu. He dreams, he looks in a mirror and sees nothing, and keeps trying to clean the mirror with his sleeve. One dream consists only of the color blue, too vivid, like the blue of a pool. An unpleasant smell keeps coming up his throat. He's both in a bag and holding a bag. Visitors flit in and out, but never Ferocious Francis or Joelle Van D. He dreams there's people in his room, but he's not one of them. He dreams he's with a very sad kid, and they're in a graveyard digging some dead guy's head up, and it's really important, like continental emergency important, and Gately's the best digger, but he's wicked hungry, like irresistibly hungry, and he's eating with both hands out of huge, economy-sized bags of corporate snacks so he can't really dig, while it gets later and later, and the sad kid is trying to scream at Gately that the important thing was buried in the guy's head, and to divert the continental emergency to start digging the guy's head up before it's too late. But the kid moves his mouth, but nothing comes out. And Joelle Van D appears with wings and no underwear, and asks if they knew him, the dead guy with the head. And Gately starts talking about knowing him, even though deep down he feels panic because he's got no idea who they're talking about, while the sad kid holds something terrible up by the hair and makes the face of somebody shouting in panic, "Too late!" She had come out of the St. E's doors and turned right for the quick walk back up to Ennett, and a grotesquely huge woman, whose hose bulged with stubble, and whose face and head were 4 times larger than the largest woman Joel had ever seen, had grabbed her arm at the elbow and said she was sorry to be the one to tell her, but that, unbeknownst to her, she was in almost mind-boggling danger. It took rather a while for Joel to look her up and down.
"This is supposed to be news?"
But that night's next AM'd found Gately and Fackelman still there in Fackelman's little corner, belts around their arms, arms and noses red from scratching, still at it, the ingestion, on a hell of a tear, cooking up and getting off and eating M&Ms when they could find their mouths with their hands, moving like men deep underwater, heads wobbling on strengthless necks, the empty room's ceiling sky blue and bulging, and under it, hanging on the wall overhead to their right, the apartment's upscale TP's viewer, on a recursive slow-mo loop of some creepy thing Fackelman liked, that was just serial shots of flames from brass lighters, kitchen matches, pilot lights, birthday candles, votive candles, pillar candles, birch shavings, Bunsen burners, etc., that Fackelman had got from Kite, who, just before dawn, had come out dressed and declined to get high with them, and coughed nervously, and announced he had to leave for a few days or more for a totally key and unmissable software trade show in a different area code. Not knowing Gately now knew he knew Fackelman already to be dead, with Kite then trying to leave discreetly with every piece of hardware he owned in his arms, including the non-portable DEC, trailing cables. Then, a bit later, as the AM light intensified yellowly and made both Gately and Fackelman curse the fact that the curtains had been stripped and pawned, as they continued to hunch and cook and shoot at maybe 0830 hours, Pamela Hoffman Jeep was up and vomiting briskly and applying mousse against the workaday day, calling Gately honey and her night errand, and asking if she'd done anything last night she'd have to explain to anybody today. Kind of an AM routine in their relationship. Applying blush and drinking her standard anti-hangover breakfast.
377.
And watching Gately and Fackelman's chins fall and rise at slightly different underwater rates. The smell of her perfume and high Retzen mints hung in the bare room long after she'd bid them both ciao bello. As the AM sun got higher and intolerable, instead of taking action and nailing a blanket or something over the window, they opted instead to obliterate the reality of the eye-scalding light and began truly binging on blues, flirting with an OD. They scaled Fackelman's Mount Dilaudid at a terrible clip. Fackelman was, by nature, a binger. Gately was typically more like a maintenance user. He rarely went on a classic-type binge, which meant plunking down in one place with an enormous stash and getting loaded over and over again for long periods without moving. But when he did start a binge, he might as well have been strapped to the snout of a missile, for all the control he had over length or momentum. Fackelman was having at the mountain of 10-milligram blues like there was no tomorrow. Every time Gately even started to bring up the issue of how Faxter had come by such a huge, blue haul of the substance, trying, maybe, to invite Fackelman to confront the reality of his trouble by describing it, like Fackelman would cut him off with a soft, "That's a goddamn lie." This was pretty much all Fackelman would ever say, when loaded, even in response to things like questions. You have to picture all the binge's verbal exchanges as occurring, like, very slowly, oddly distended, as if the time were honey.
"Serious fucking stash you managed to come by somehow right here, fat. That's a goddamn lie. Man. I just hope Gwen Dean the C's got the phone today out there, man. Instead of Whitey. No business getting done out of here today, I don't think. It's a goddamn lie. That's for sure, Fax. It's a goddamn lie. Fax. The Faxter. Count Factula. Goddamn lie.
After a while, in all the distension, it got to be like a joke. Gailey would haul his big head upright and try to allege the roundness of the planet, the three-dimensionality of the phenomenal world, the blackness of all black dogs.
It's a goddamn lie.
They found it increasingly funny. After every exchange like this, they laughed and laughed. Each exhalation of laughter seemed to take several minutes. The ceiling and the window's light receded. Fackelman wet his pants. This was even funnier. They watched the pool of urine spread out against the hardwood floor, changing shape, growing curved arms, exploring the fine oak floor. The rises and valleys and little seams. It might have gotten later, and then early AM again. The entertainment cartridge's myriad small flames were reflected in the spreading puddle, so that soon Gately could watch without taking his chin off his chest. When the phone rang, it was just a fact. The ringing was like an environment, not a signal. The fact of its ringing got more and more abstract. Whatever a ringing phone might signify was like totally overwhelmed by the overwhelming fact of its ringing. Gately pointed this out to Fackelman. Fackelman vehemently denied it. At some point, Gately tried to stand and was rudely assaulted by the floor and wet his own pants. The phone rang and rang. At another point, they got interested in rolling different colors of peanut M&Ms into the puddles of urine and watching the colored dye corrode and leave a vampire white football of M&M in a nimbus of bright dye. The intercom's buzzer to the luxury apartment complex's glass doors downstairs sounded, overwhelming both of them with the fact of its sound. It buzzed and buzzed. They discussed wishing it would stop, the way you discuss wishing it would stop raining. It became the ICBM of binges. The substance seemed inexhaustible. Mount Dilaudid changed shapes, but never really much shrank that they could see. It was the first and only time, ever, that Gately IV'd narcotics so many times in one arm that he ran out of arm vein and had to switch to the other arm. Fackelman was no longer coordinated enough to help him tie off and boot. Fackelman kept making a string of chocolatey drool appear and distend almost down to the floor. The acidity of their urine was corroding the apartment's hardwood floor's finish in an observable way. The puddle had grown many arms, like a Hindu god. Gately couldn't quite tell if the urine had explored its way almost back to their feet or if they were already sitting in urine. Fackelman would see how close to the surface of the pond of their mixed piss he could get the tip of the string of spit before he sucked it back up and in. The little game had an intoxicating aura of danger to it. The insight that most people like play danger but don't like real-life danger hit Gately like an epiphany. It took him gallons of viscous time to try and articulate the insight to Fackelman so that Fackelman could give it the imprimatur of a denial. Eventually, the buzzer stopped. The phrase, "more tattoos than teeth," also kept going through Gately's head as it bobbed the head, even though he had no idea where the phrase came from or who it was supposed to refer to. He hadn't been to Billerica Minimum yet. He was on bail. That Whitey Sorkin had bonded. The taste of the M&Ms couldn't cut the weirdly sweet medical taste of hydromorphone in Gately's mouth. He watched an old stovetop burner's crown of blue flame shimmer in the shine of the urine. During a ruddled sunset light period, Fackelman had had a small convulsion and a bowel movement in his pants, and Gately hadn't had the coordination to go to Fackelman's side during the seizure to help and just be there. He had the nightmarish feeling that there was something crucial he had to do, but had forgot what it was. 10 milligram injections of the Blue Bayou kept the feeling at bay for shorter and shorter periods. He had never heard of somebody having a convulsion from an OD, and Fackelman had indeed seemed to bounce to his version of back. The sun outside the big windows seemed to go up and down, like a yo-yo. They ran out of the distilled water Fackelman had in the mixing bowl and Falcomen took a cotton and sopped up candy-dyed urine off the floor and cooked up with urine. Gately appeared to himself to be repulsed by this, but there was no question of trying to get to the stripped kitchen for the distilled water bottle. Gately was tying off his right arm with his teeth now. His left was so useless. Falcomen smelled very bad. Gately nodded out into a dream where he was on a Beverly Needham bus, whose side said, Paragon Bus Lines, the Grey Line. In his stuporous recall over 4 years later in St. Elizabeth's, he realizes that this bus is the bus from the dream that wouldn't end and wouldn't go anywhere, but has the sickening realization that the connection between the two buses is itself a dream, or is in a dream, and it's now that his fever returns to new heights, and his line on the heart monitor gets a funny little hitch, like a serration at the first and third nodes, which makes an amber light flash at the nurse's station down the hall. When the buzzer sounded again, they were watching the Flames film late at night. Now, poor old Pamela Hoffman Jeep's voice came to them through the intercom. The intercom and apartment complex front door's unlocker button were all the way across the living room by the apartment door. The ceiling bulged and receded. Falcomen had made his hand into the shape of a claw and was studying the claw in the light of the teepee's flames. Mount Allotted was badly caved in on one side. A disastrous avalanche into Lake Huron was a possibility. PHJ sounded drunk as a nook. She said to let her in. She said she knew they were in there. She used party as a verb several times. Falcomen was whispering that it was a lie. Gately remembers he actually had to prod himself in the bladder to feel if he had to go to the bathroom. His unit felt small and icy cold against his leg in the wet jeans. The ammoniac smell of urine and the breathing ceiling and drunk distant female voice. Gately reached in the dark for the bars of his playpen, grasped them with pudgy fists, hauled himself to his feet. His rising was more like the floor lowering. He wobbled like a toddler. The apartment floor below him fainted right, left, circling for an opening to attack. The luxury windows hung with starlight. Falcomen had made his claw come alive into a spider and was letting the spider climb slowly down his chest area. The starlight was smeary. There were no distinct stars. Everything out of the line of fire of the cartridge viewer was dark as a pocket. The buzzer sounded angry and the voice pathetic. Gately put his foot out in the direction of the buzzer. He heard Falcomen telling his hands, claws, spider it was witnessing the birth of an empire. Then, when Gately put his foot down, there was nothing there. The floor dodged his foot and rushed up at him. He caught a glimpse of bulged ceiling, and then the floor caught him in the temple. His ears belled. The impact of the floor against him shook the whole room. A box of laminates teetered and fell, and fanned clear laminates all over the wet floor. The viewer fell off the wall and cast ruddled flames on the ceiling. The floor jammed itself against Gately, pressing in tight, and he grayed out with his scrunched face toward Falcomen and the windows beyond, with Falcomen holding the spider out in midair at him for his inspection.
Oh, for Christ's sake, then. I was in two scenes. What else is in there I do not know. In the first scene, I'm going through a revolving door, you know, around in this glass revolving door, and going around out. As I go in is somebody I know but apparently haven't seen for a long time, because the recognition calls for a shocked look, and the person sees me and gives an equally shocked look. We're supposedly formerly very close and now haven't seen each other in the longest time, and the meeting is a random chance. And instead of going in, I keep going around in the door to follow the person out, which person is also still revolving in the door to follow me in, and we whirl in the door like that for several whirls.
Question.
The actor was male. He wasn't one of Jim's regulars, but the character I recognize in the door is Epicene.
Question.
Hermaphroditic. Androgynous. It wasn't obvious that the character was supposed to be a male character. I assume you can identify.
The other had the camera bolted down inside a stroller or bassinet. I wore an incredible white floor-length gown of some sort of flowing material and leaned in over the camera in the crib and simply apologized.
Question.
Apologized, as in my lines were various apologies. I'm so sorry. I'm so terribly sorry. I am so, so sorry. Please know how very, very, very sorry I am. For a real long time. I doubt he used it all. I strongly doubt he used it all, but there were at least 20 minutes of permutations of, I'm sorry.
Question.
Not exactly. Not exactly veiled.
Question.
The point of view was from the crib, yes. A crib's eye view. But that's not what I mean by driving the scene. The camera was fitted with a lens with something Jim called, I think, an auto wobble. Ocular wobble, something like that. A ball and socket joint behind the mount that made the lens wobble a little bit. It made a weird little tiny whirring noise, I recollect.
Question.
The mount's the barrel. The mount's what the elements of the lens are arranged in. This crib lens's mount projected out way farther than a conventional lens, but it wasn't near as big around as a catadioptric lens. It looked more like an eye stalk or a night vision scope than a lens. Long and skinny and projecting, with this slight wobble. I don't know much about lenses beyond basic concepts like length and speed. Lenses were Jim's forte. This can't be much of a surprise. He always had a whole case full. He paid more attention to the lenses and lights than to the camera. His other son carried them in a special case. Leith was cameras. The son was lenses. Lenses, Jim said, were what he had to bring to the whole enterprise. Of filmmaking. Of himself. He made all his own.
Question.
Well, I've never been around them, but I know there's something wobbled and weird about their vision, supposedly. I think the newer born they are, the more they wobble. Plus, I think a milky blur. Neonatal nystagmus. I don't know where I heard that term. I don't remember. It could have been Jim. It could have been the sun. What I know about infants, personally, you could... It may have been an astigmatic lens. I don't think there's much doubt the lens was supposed to reproduce an infantile visual field. But that's what you could feel was driving the scene. My face wasn't important. You never got the sense it was meant to be captured realistically by this lens.
Question.
I never saw it. I've got no idea.
Question.
They were buried with him. The masters of everything unreleased. At least, that was in his will.
Question.
It had nothing to do with killing himself. Less than nothing to do with it.
Question.
No, I never saw his fucking will. He told me things. He'd stop being drunk all the time. That killed him. He couldn't take it, but he'd made a promise.
Question.
I don't know that he ever even got a finished master. That's your story. There wasn't anything unendurable or enslaving in either of my scenes. Nothing like these actual perfection rumors. These are academic rumors. He talked about making something, quote, too perfect, but as a joke. He had a thing about entertainment, being criticized about entertainment versus non-entertainment and stasis. He used to refer to the work itself as entertainments. He always meant it ironically. Even in jokes, he never talked about an anti-aversion or antidote, for God's sake. He'd never carry it that far, a joke. When he talked about this thing as a, quote, perfect entertainment, terminally compelling, it was always ironic. He was having a sly little jab at me. I used to go around saying the veil was to disguise lethal perfection, that I was too lethally beautiful for people to stand. It was a kind of joke I'd gotten from one of his entertainments, the Medusa odalisk thing. That even in UHID I hid by hiddenness in denial about the deformity itself. So Jim took a failed piece and told me it was too perfect to release. It'd paralyze people. It was entirely clear that it was an ironic joke to me.
Question.
Jim's humor was a dry humor.
Question.
If it got made and nobody's seen it, the master, it's in there with him, buried. That's just a guess, but I bet you. Call it an educated bet.
Question.
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 Question. That's the part of the joke he didn't know. Where he's buried is itself buried now. It's in your annihilation zone. It's not even your territory. And now if you want the thing, he'd enjoy the joke very much, I think. Oh, shit, yes. Very much. By a rather creepy coincidence, it turned out that up in our room, Kyle Dempsey, Coyle, and Mario were also watching one of himself's old efforts. Mario had gotten his pants on and was using a special tool to zip and button. Coyle looked oddly traumatized. He was sitting on the edge of my bed, his eyes wide and his whole body with the slight tremble of something hanging from the tip of a pipette. Mario greeted me by name. Snow continued to whirl and eddy outside the window. The position of the sun was impossible to gauge. The net posts were now buried almost up to their scorecard attachments. The wind was piling snow up in drifts against all Academy right angles, and then pummeling the drifts into unusual shapes. The window's whole view had the gray, grainy quality of a poor photo. The sky looked diseased. Mario worked his tool with great patience. It often took him several tries to catch and engage the tool's jaws on the tongue of his zipper. Coyle, still wearing his apnea mouthguard, stared at our room's little viewer. The cartridge was himself's accomplice, a short melodrama with Cosgrove Watt and a boy no one had ever seen before or since. "You woke up early," Mario said, smiling up from his fly. His bed was made up drum tight. I smiled. Turns out I wasn't the only one. "You look sad." I raised my hand with the NASA glass at Coyle. "An unexpected pleasure, KDC."
"Thith thick of meth," Coyle said.
I put the glass and toothbrush on my dresser and straightened its doily. I picked some clothing up and began separating it by smell into wearable and unwearable.
"Kyle says Jim Trolch tore some of Ortho's face off, trying to pull him off a window his face got glued to," Mario said. "And then Jim Trolch and Mr. Kinkle tried to put toilet tissue on the ripped parts, the way Tall Paul sometimes puts little bits of Kleenex on a shaving cut. But Ortho's face was a lot worse than a shaving cut, and they used a whole roll. And now Ortho's face is covered with toilet tissue. And the tissue's stuck now, and Ortho can't get it off. And at breakfast, Mr. DeLint was yelling at Ortho for letting them put toilet tissue on it. And Ortho ran to his and Kyle's room and locked the door, and Kyle doesn't have his key since the accident with the whirlpool."
I helped Mario on with his police locks vest and affixed the Velcro nice and tight. Mario's chest is so fragile feeling that I could feel his heartbeats tremble through the vest and sweatshirt. Coyle removed the apnea guard. Strings of white, nighttime oral material appeared between his mouth and the guard as he extracted it. He looked to Mario.
"Tell him the worst part."
I was watching Coyle very closely to see what he planned to do with the sickening mouthpiece he held.
"Hey, Hal, your phone has messages, and Mike Pemulis came by and asked if you were up and about."
"You haven't told him the worst part of it," Coyle said.
"Don't even think about putting that thing down anywhere my bed, Kyle, please."
"I'm holding it away from everything, don't worry."
Mario used his tool to zip up the long curved zipper of his backpack.
"Kyle said there was a problem with a discharge again."
"So I heard," I said.
"And Kyle says he woke up and Ortho was missing, and Ortho's bed was missing as well, so he turned on the light."
Coyle gestured with the appliance.
"And lo and fucking capital B, behold."
"Yes, and lo," Mario said. "Ortho's bed is up near the ceiling of their room. The frame has some way got lifted up and bolted to the ceiling, sometime during the night without Kyle hearing it or waking up.
Until the discharge, that is, I said. This is it, said Coyle. The tin cans and accusations I'm moving his stuff around are one thing. I'm going to lateral Alice for a switch like Trolch did. This is the straw.
Mario said, and his bed's up on the ceiling now still. And if it falls, it's going to go right through the floor and fall in Graham and Petropolis's room.
He's in there right now, all mummified in toilet paper, sulking, with his bed hanging overhead, with a door locked. So I can't even get my apnea guard cleaning supplies, Coyle said.
I'd heard nothing about Trolch apparently switching room assignments with Trevor Axford. A gigantic wedge of snow slid down a steep part of the roof over our window and fell past the window and hit the ground below with a huge whoomp. For some reason, the fact that something as major as a midterm room switch could have taken place without my knowing anything about it filled me with dread. There were a few glitters of a possible, incipient panic attack again.
Mario's bedside table had a tube of salve for his pelvis's burn, unevenly squeezed. Mario was looking at my face.
Is it you're sad about not getting to play if the Quebec players are canceled?
And then to crown off the whole night, he ends up with his face glued to a window, Coyle said disgustedly.
Frozen, I corrected him.
Except, but now listen to Stice's explanation.
Let me guess, I said.
For the bed hovering.
Mario looked at Coyle.
You said bolted.
I said presumably bolted is what I said. I said the only rationale that's possible is bolts.
Let me guess, I said.
Let him guess, Mario told Coyle.
The darkness thinks ghosts.
Coyle stood and came toward us. His two eyes were not set quite level in his face.
Stice's explanation that he swore me to discretion, but that was before the bed was on the ceiling, was he thinks he's been somehow selected or chosen to get haunted or possessed by some kind of beneficiary or guardian ghost that resides in and or manifests in ordinary physical objects, that wants to teach the darkness how to not underestimate ordinary objects and raise his game to, like, a supernatural level to help his game.
One eye was subtly lower than the other and set at a different angle.
Or hurt somebody else's, I said.
Stice is mentally buckling,
Coyle said, still moving in. I was careful to stay just out of morning breath range.
He keeps staring at things with his temple veins flexing, trying to exert will on them. He bet me 20 beans he could stand on his desk chair and lift it up at the same time. And then he wouldn't let me cancel the bet when I got embarrassed for him after half an hour, standing up there flexing his temples.
I was also keeping a careful eye on the oral appliance.
Did you guys hear sausage analog and fresh squeezed for breakfast?
Mario asked again if I were sad.
Coyle said, I was down there. Stice's map was taking the edge off appetites all over the room. Then DeLint started yelling at him.
He was looking at me oddly.
I don't see what's so funny about it, man.
Mario fell backward onto his bed and wriggled into his backpack's straps with practiced ease.
Coyle said, I don't know if I should go to Shtit or Rusk or what, or Lateral Alice. What if they haul him off somewhere and it's my fault?
There's no denying the Dark's raised his game this fall, though.
There are machine messages on the machine howl, too,
Mario said as I held his hands carefully and pulled him upright.
What if it's the mental buckling that's raised his game?
Coyle said.
Does it still count as buckling?
Cosgrove Watt had been one of the very few professional actors himself ever used. Himself often liked to use rank amateurs. He wanted them simply to read their lines with an amateur's wooden self-consciousness off cue cards Mario or Disney Leith would hold up, well to the side of wherever the character was supposed to be looking. Up until the last phase of his career, himself had apparently thought the stilted wooden quality of non-professionals helped to strip away the pernicious illusion of realism and to remind the audience that they were, in reality, watching actors acting and not people behaving. Like the Parisian French Bresson he so admired, himself had no interest in succoring the audience with illusory realism, he said.
The apparent irony of the fact that it required non-actors to achieve this stilted, artificial, I'm only acting here quality was one of very few things about himself's early projects that truly interested academic critics. But the real truth was,